Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is Janet Sumner Johnson, author of the middle grade novel, The Last Great Adventure of the PB&J Society. She joined me to talk about querying when you already have a book published and the complexities of having different agencies handling your separate projects. Since this podcast is aimed at aspiring writers, I like to ask my guests about the process through which they got an agent. So who is your agent and how long were you querying before you landed her?
So Lauren Gallett is my current agent. She's actually my second agent. This time it didn't take as long as the first time. I was querying about 3 months. And in that 3 months, I sent out 56 queries. I got 10 requests from that and 2 offers. Much easier than the first time. The first time it was a year and a half long process. I didn't send out much more. I sent out 63 queries the first time, but I had more requests. It was just so close so many times. 8 partials, 9 fulls, through all of that, 1 offer. Querying is not for the weak of heart. It just takes so much determination and belief in yourself that, you know what, it doesn't matter if these people are rejecting me. It's going to find its home. I believe it's good.
So the second time you were out querying, did you already have a published novel?
Yes, I did. My first book was out. It had been out about 6 months. So that, I think, was really helpful. I put that in my query that I was the author of The Last Great Adventure of the PB&J Society. And also, I parted ways amicably with my agent. So that really helped. So they knew I'd worked with an agent before. I knew what it was like. I mean, you definitely don't need to have a book out to be successful in querying. They expect that you don't have a book out, I think, for the most part.
Do you want to talk a little bit about why you split with your first agent?
My first agent was switching agencies, and so she couldn't take all of her clients with her, so we parted ways. Fortunately, I had a book that was ready to go, so I was able to just jump right in. Literally the day she told me, I said, so am I good to start querying? She's like, yep, absolutely. So I just jumped in and started querying right away. Entered that long process. You start out really confident, like, you know, I just had an agent, and she's already read through this manuscript. It's going to be fabulous. And then, a month passes, and then 2 months pass. I actually, with my current agent, she asked for an R&R. Which is a revise and resubmit. I liked what she had to say about it. I thought her ideas were really strong. I knew someone that she represented, and I was able to talk to her in advance and get a good idea of what she was like as an agent. The first time I sent the full, she read it in 3 days. I was like, whoa. I was just really impressed. Fortunately for me, I was able to revise it. In fact, she had me do just part of it, and I think that's because I'd published before. I did 4 chapters, I think, and she looked at it, read through it, and a week later we had another phone conversation and she offered. Obviously, because I only did 3 or 4 chapters, I had a lot of revision to do. And I did get another offer with an agent I also really loved. It was so hard.
It is hard. For my first interview for this podcast, I interviewed Kate Carius Quinn, and she talked about having to choose when you have more than one agent offering to represent you. And it is very difficult. It sounds like a real first world problem, and it is, but at the same time, it's not an easy decision to make. And I think, too, that it's good for aspiring writers and beginning writers, even ones that may be published or already agented, to know that changing agents, switching agents, this happens. It's fairly common. Most writers are not with one agent for their entire lives. So even though it can be very stressful if you were to lose your agent for one reason or another, it's not the end of the world. My agent switched agencies, gosh, maybe a year ago. She was originally with Wolf Literary, and then she moved to Foundry. And she called me to tell me that she was switching agencies.
Oh.
And so I get this phone call from the agent. We have a really great relationship, but generally I'm just not a phone person. So when I see the phone ringing and it's my agent for an unscheduled phone call, I was just like, oh, it's either really good or really bad.
Right. Stomach drop.
Yes, exactly. And she said, hey, I need to talk to you about, and she said, you know, I'm moving over to Foundry. And I was like, okay. And I know that they, either are able to take their clients with them or they are not. And I didn't know. And she said, I was hoping that you could come with me. And I'm like, oh, I'm really glad that you're taking me with you because I really love my agent. My agent is Adrienne Ranta. She recently married, so her Adrienne Ranta's or Helen now.
It is great because you don't always know. And a lot of people ask about that. They're like, well, so wait, is that just her way of getting rid of you? Mm-hmm. Like, no, it's a real thing. They can't take everybody.
Yeah, they can't. And sometimes it depends on where the contract is written because the contract is with the agency.
So I actually have another agent I work with that's at the agency I first signed with.
Right.
That was assigned because she left. So the agency got to keep my book and any royalties that may come from that. So I will work with two agents now, my agent going forward and my agent with that one book.
Yeah. Yes, I'm in the same situation. So I have an agent at Wolf Literary that handles all my backlist.
Wow.
That Adrienne sold for me through Wolf. And I work with Adrienne handling my new projects going forward, which are through Foundry. So yeah, that's another thing that most aspiring writers aren't going to know, and even some established aren't going to know, that your contract, any books that sell, all of your royalties, all of your statements, all any money coming from those is still handled through you, the agency that sold them, even if your agent leaves and you leave. Because it is a little confusing, and no one sits you down and tells you anything. That's one of the reasons I started this podcast, is that no one sits you down and explains anything to you. Suddenly you are a published writer and
fumbling, trying to figure out all these little details. Wait, how does that work again? I had a lot of writing friends, author friends who had parted with their first agent. So I don't want to say fortunate because I know it was really hard on them, but I had that resource and I knew it was a really common thing. Like most of my author friends had parted with an agent. Of course, of them, I was the only one that had a published book out already. So that was new waters for me. It's really helpful to know what to expect when you hit these points and there's just silence. It's really hard to find this information. No one wants to talk about the dread of losing an agent.
Yeah, I find that too. There's a lot of cloak and dagger in the publishing industry. Yes. And I think it adds to the romanticism of it, but it also isn't terribly helpful for those of us that have to deal with the practicalities. With that in mind, with the whole agent query process and the aspiring author venue, are there any can't-miss resources out there that you think aspiring writers should be aware of? What did you rely on when you were querying?
So many. So my very absolute favorite for querying authors is querytracker.net.
That's a good one.
I don't even know how people did it before, but it has all the agents in there, so you can find agents that way. And not only that, it's got the links to places like Literary Rambles, which is another amazing resource. They've done all the research for you, so you can look up a lot of agents that way. Brenda Drake, she's amazing. I don't know how she manages to publish and do all that she does with contests out there. Getting involved with her pitch wars, or I did her pitch madness, and that's actually how I ended up getting my first agent. Dee Romito with her Query Sign Submit series, I think is really informative. Not many people talk about past that querying stage. I love that she's got information about what it's like to be on submission and the steps that happen when you're looking to sign with an agent and what you should be asking.
Some of these haven't been mentioned before on the podcast, so that is wonderful. I'll make sure to link off to them. Next up, the challenge of writing for middle graders, the assumption that books for children are somehow lesser than books written for adults, as well as the question of what content to include for younger readers. Now, moving on to the actual finished product of our books, I deal occasionally with some condescension. I have people ask, when are you going to write a real book? To which I usually tell them, if you pick up a box of my books, you will find that they are quite real. You write middle grade. Do you deal with any sort of condescension from not necessarily other writers, but just the general reading public, a little edge of condescension because you write for kids?
You know, I know it's out there. I feel like probably I'm just oblivious for the most part. I have seen it though. I've seen it with other authors. I've heard them mention it. You know, I was at a conference recently where an adult author was talking about an event they went to and they spoke and everyone was like this deadpan audience. A middle grade author got up after them and read their part and everyone was so into it. And he's like, it's a dog, people. And I'm like, don't underestimate the power of the dog. Middle grade literature and YA literature and children's literature is amazing. It covers so many topics in ways that adult literature does not. I took a class from Shannon Hale just after she received the Newbery Honor. She took an MFA course. She faced that. Everyone was totally looking down on her. Afterwards, she's like the most successful in the whole program that she went through. And yet they're like, oh no, whatever. You wrote for children. That just doesn't even count. So she also writes for adults. So she said, when you compare the editing process for the adult stuff that I wrote versus the children's stuff, she said it was so much more intense for the children's literature. People seem to think that because it's written for children, it's lesser. It's not. It's hard. It's hard to write for children. It's hard to get in that mindset and remember what it was like to be a child, yet still get through like the gatekeepers and the all the people who have to decide to let children read that book.
As a children's writer, you have to not only write a book that's good enough to be published, you have to write a book that parents and librarians are going to want their child to read or allow their child to read. And so that kind of leads me into the next question. You write for middle grade, which is a younger audience. So some things you absolutely know you can't touch. I mean, like, no sex, obviously. I worked in a library for 15 years, and I was always amused at what children's books were banned. So, like, The Stupids were always getting banned. Captain Underpants. Humor that the kids enjoy, that the parents might think is crude. And those are picture book examples, but I know plenty of middle grade books that have been banned for, I think, really silly reasons. And then I come across some middle grades that I will read, and they're very clever in how they get some of their content in there so as not to have the gatekeepers up in arms. And typically, in my experience, as a person that has worked in the library, librarians are usually the ones that are championing these books, and the parents are the ones that tend to get upset. So do you worry about content? And how do you navigate the sticky arena of these gatekeepers?
Absolutely. I mean, you cannot be a middle grade writer without worrying about the content. In fact, just a quick funny story to start that off. I was querying a book. It was before I had an agent. And it had one of her favorite drinks. My character's favorite drinks was virgin strawberry daiquiris. And so that was in my query, just one more virgin strawberry daiquiri. And it was on a forum, and it kind of exploded. You cannot say the word virgin in a middle grade query. It's not the same meaning. It's a drink.
No, it's not the same meaning. And, also, it's not a bad word.
Right, exactly. I just watched the debate back and forth. A lot of really strong opinions about this word virgin that I'd used to refer to the drink. And finally, an agent got on there, and she's like, honestly, people, calm down. It's fine. I really think about the words I use, and when they want to call someone a name, I have to really think about that. What am I willing to put in my book? What are parents going to be upset about?
Like, I'm assuming you even have to be careful about using the word stupid.
Yes.
I have seen kids gasp and cover their mouths when someone says a word that I think is perfectly innocent, and their kids are just shocked. I'm wondering how you navigate that. If you want to write an insult that is going to cut and work, you're going to have to go there.
You have to choose your moments. I really want a big effect right here, so I'm going to use the word idiot. Honestly, I've taught my kids that. When I say stupid myself, they look at me horrified, like, Mom, I can't believe you said that. My 13-year-old will get all serious and say, Mom, could you please watch your language? I'm like, okay, I'm sorry.
Wow. You probably shouldn't introduce him to me then, just saying.
So I get it because I'm a parent. And so I have kids who do, it's a strong word for them because we don't use it in our home. And, you know, you teach them when they're little, you don't want them to start just calling people names. It starts to come back to haunt you later as you get older. Mm-hmm. These words you use yourself.
You make a really good point. In that sometimes the gatekeepers are the children themselves. It's not necessarily the librarians or the parents that read a word or think, oh, this is inappropriate. There are times that you have readers, students, children that don't care for your word choice. And that's an important thing to remember because we tend to think of the adults as the ones preventing our books from getting to the children. But there are definitely children that don't care to read that kind of content. Now, in my experience, because I write YA, I have had a few times, not many, but once or twice, I have had students question me on word choices, mostly that I used in Not a Drop to Drink, which I told them. I was like, if you had some problems with some of the words that I used in this book, that's fine. Don't read any of my other ones because this is the tamest, okay? I always say to them, you know, my job is to write for you a book that is realistic and honest about a fictional world. And I'm writing about a post-apocalyptic society where people are killing each other for water. They might say shit sometimes. They're going to say asshole. And there's one time when a woman uses the F word and she's giving birth. So she earned it. Okay. And so the kids, usually they'll roll with that. But I do have that momentary, oh man, I'm sorry that you read that and it offended you. Like, I don't mean to offend you. My experience as a librarian is that when I see a kid hit a content or arena that they are uncomfortable with, they put the book down. And I take solace in that because I know that if they find something in there that is too much for them, they will put it down. And I rely on that self-censorship by the readers themselves.
Yes, definitely. And I think that's an important thing to remember too. And with middle grade in particular, there's already so many things you just don't do. Like all those words, I just don't even, that's not even a question. I'm not
even touch them.
Kids are really discerning. They know when they are not enjoying content. Readers progress as they go along. You know, they may not see all the nuance and recognize like the greatness of these award winner books that receive all the accolades. They're going to recognize a good story, though. Yes. But those words can definitely hold them back. And I know that my son, as he's progressed in his reading, has definitely put books aside. There was a book, he really wanted to read it, and we got the book for him, and he was very distraught when he found a word that really bothered him. So we gave him the power. We gave him a black Sharpie and said, you know what? Just mark those words off. And it was like this lightning bolt for him. Like, I can do that? I can. I said, it's your book. Go for it. It's not censorship on a broad scale, but for him, it makes the book enjoyable.
I have a deep love of used books, and I will go to bookstores and I end up picking up books that I had as a child that I just instinctually have this reaction where I pick them up and I buy them because I love to see them again. I may not even read them again, but I love to see them again.
Yes.
So you may remember, perhaps, back in the 1980s, there was a series from Scholastic called The Sunfire Romances. Do you remember those by chance?
I don't.
The title was A Girl's Name. So the first one was Amanda. And they were set in a historical setting. Every one of them was different. First one was the Oregon Trail. Second one was Salem Witch Trials. And there was always a love triangle. Like, that was the entire point of the book, which
I'm
was
have to look these up.
Oh my gosh, they're so much fun. I love these things. I read the whole series. Some of them are actually quite good. I reread some recently just for the joy of it. The love triangle is usually quite laughable because there's usually one like really obviously bad choice.
Right. Yep.
But they were wonderful books. And it was kind of like, for me, looking back on it, I'm seeing that these are YA. Scholastic printed them, but we didn't really have that term, I don't believe. And they're teen romances, teen historical romances, and they really are pretty fantastic. But I had spotted a couple of them, and I picked them up at a used bookstore, and I brought them home, was paging through them, and after looking at some of the inscription and things like that, it looked like a grandmother had purchased these for her granddaughter, had read them beforehand, and she had taken a pen, and there were only a few instances, but she had taken a pen and had, you know, drawn a line through a few words that she apparently didn't think that her granddaughter was ready to read. And I appreciated that she still wanted her to have this book and to read this story, but to still protect her just a little bit.
Absolutely. And I think recognizing a book is not just a bunch of words, you know, there's so much value that can come from the stories, and you may not like one word in there, but to throw out the whole book because of one word that you particularly don't like. So I think that's really great too. I think a lot of times people are so hesitant to give books that sound girlish to their sons. And I've been very careful not to do that with my kids. I give them princess books all the time.
So this happens to me more than once. I'll be at a book fair or a book festival, somewhere where I'm table selling. I will have a grandparent or a parent ask me, what are your books about? And so I will pitch them. And then they'll say, well, I'm looking for a book for my 13 or 15-year-old son or grandson. Like, well, they would probably really enjoy Not a Drop to Drink. They're like, but you're a girl and your main character's a girl. And I just don't think they'd connect. And I'm like, dude, seriously, when I have events, the people that show up and are the most excited, it's usually dudes. When it's for Not a Drop to Drink, they're way into it. So do you run across that a lot? Do you run across any kind of gender bias with your title?
People absolutely ask that question. Is it meant for a girl or a boy? And I think one of the reasons my publisher really liked it is because Annie's best friend is a boy. And mm-hmm. So basically the two main characters, one boy and one girl, it's Annie's perspective. Teachers comment on that all the time, that it's a big deal that boys need to feel connected somehow. They'll look at you skeptically when you say, no, it's good for a boy too. Like, yeah, right. You're a girl. I'm like, okay, I could have used my first initials, like J.K. Rowling, right? Harry Potter, yep. I like that one, right? It doesn't matter who wrote the book. We are people. We live in a world all together. Half the population are women, half the population are men. We deal with other genders all the time. Why would it make a difference? Why would it matter that we're a girl?
Right. If I'm capable of imagining a post-apocalyptic world where people are murdering each other over water, I'm capable of imagining how a boy thinks.
I think so. It's, you know, all of this is coming from our imagination. We have to make up a lot of stuff. Imagine how other people, because it's just mm-hmm. people, you know, how they would feel in a situation.
Yeah, it's empathy.
Exactly.
Authors having empathy, and I would say the vast majority of us do, which is why we are able to execute a story about non-existent people and give them empathy. And I think that's an important point too, that then that translates to the reader. So if we're just going to give boys boy books and girl girl books, then we're reiterating to them that there's a line, that there's a divide. And in a lot of ways, there's not.
There really isn't. There's no divide. There's books about people who are doing different things, whether they're girls or boys. And we should strive to have empathy for people who are not like us. That includes mm-hmm. people of a different gender. Why would we not want to read books about them?
I enjoy, too, that there is a deep, close friendship between a boy and a girl. My best friends were boys when I was growing up. All my cousins were boys that were my age. All my friends were boys. And, you know, there's the awkwardness as you get older.
Yes.
And, you know, you're changing and things are kind of weird sometimes. Like, to this day, my closest friends are males. And so I appreciate seeing that in a book for middle graders, because some of those friendships, you know, they built empathy in me. They helped me understand the other. I get compliments on how I write male characters. And the reason why I'm able to do that with any kind of skill whatsoever is because of my understanding and close friendships with boys from a very young age. It's important to illustrate those two young kids so that they know, you know, it's not weird that your friends are boys. It's not weird that your friends are girls. There's nothing wrong with this. It's cool. Roll with it. If they're your friends, then they're your friends.
Exactly. And I think that so many times we push kids without even realizing it into behaving certain ways, such as girls hang out with girls, boys hang out with boys, and we don't mix. Even at a young age, we start to do that. Well, here's the trucks for the boys. Well, you know what? Girls like to play with trucks too.
So we even line them up in the classroom.
Yes.
When, you know, it's time to go to lunch. Boys over here, girls over here.
It's definitely a topic that I deal with in my book is Annie and Jason have this great friendship. They've been friends for their whole life. And yet all the kids around them are like, ooh, you guys are lovey-dovey or whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, it's not like that. And they have to really stand up for their friendship. They have to fight for it because the world around them is saying you're weird. And it's not true.
Yeah. Yeah. And they make assumptions yeah. about your friendship that aren't true. And that's very frustrating coming from someone that had those friendships. Like, even into, like, high school, people just, they make assumptions about what you do together. And it's also, it can be toxic to the friendship because yeah. it makes things uncomfortable for both of you. And
it's easier just to step away, which is tragic, I think.
It is tragic.
Friendship is a true gift. And to just walk away from it because of other people, it's, I think it's a sad thing.
finishing out with favorite books from our childhood and how we interpret them differently as adult readers, the skill involved in layering a children's book in a way that will change the meaning for an older reader, and where to find Janet online. Okay, continuing with the last great adventure of the PB&J Society, it's highly funny. And I think writing humor is the most challenging thing of all. It's very, very difficult to make people laugh. I'm much better at making them cry. I think that writing humor is the most challenging. Do you worry that some things that are funny in your head won't translate into humor on the page?
All the time. I am constantly reading what I write to my husband just to gauge his reaction. Is it sincere laughter that he's giving me, or is this like his pity laugh because he knows I really want it to be funny? I write humor because I struggle to write serious stuff. I sit down, I'm going to write a serious book, and it doesn't come out that way. I like to laugh at the world. Early on, I had to decide, you know, I can't assume that I can make everybody laugh with the same joke. It's not going to happen. And so I'm going to choose my audience, which one is middle grade. But I also think it's important to consider, again, back to the gatekeepers. And so I've got jokes in there, things that are funny to the adults, to the gatekeepers, that the kids probably will miss. Hopefully they'll get it someday as they go back and read this book from their childhood or whatever. Yeah, and I've been slammed in reviews on, oh, she thinks she's so funny and she's not. And I've had the opposite too. Oh, this is the funniest book. I laughed so hard. You know, it's a hit and miss. And I think that's true with any genre. Your serious books, you're going to resonate with some people and you're not going to resonate with others.
I have some humor in my books, a lot of just real dry humor that you'll slide in there. But I have a humorous paranormal, right? And I've been trying to get this book published for 15 years because it's been the hardest thing to make work. I mean, I have published in post-apoc and historical and fantasy and contemporary, but damn it, that humor one, I just can't land. It's so hard. I think it's the most difficult.
The thing about any genre is you really need the broad spectrum. You don't want to just, I mean, I'm funny. My book is mostly funny, but I have those hard moments in there too where people are sad. I just finished A Madness So Discreet, and that is a serious book. Like, whoa, the topic, that is a heavy topic. There were still lots of moments where you had me laughing. You heard, like you said, that dry humor. And I think that's really important that you have that spread. Just because you write a serious book does not mean you're not going to have any humor in there. And just because I write a humorous book does not mean there are not going to be serious moments in there. I do want to say, you know, it's the humor, that's where I really connected with my agent and my editor.
I recently read a book that I want to talk about really quick. It's called Optimists Die First by Susan Nielsen. It's YA, it's humor, but it's about something very tragic. It is about an older sister whose little sister died while she was under her care. She was supposed to be looking out for her, and she died. So obviously that is tragic as hell, but the book is so funny that her little sister died in a complete freak accident. And this older sister is now moving through life, trying to anticipate anything bad that could possibly happen. When I read it, I was so impressed at the handling of a very hard situation with complete humor.
So Annie, in my book, she's looking for lots of different ways to try and save Jason's house. One of those that she lands on is selling her appendix on eBay. And when I had first written that, it probably was like a mistake. I was just going really fast, and then I realized, oh, duh, it's not supposed to be appendix. It's supposed to be kidney.
But you don't need your appendix. You wouldn't get anything for an appendix.
Exactly. It was so funny. So I left it in there thinking, okay, I think it's funny. Maybe everyone else will be like, it's dumb. And it became part of my pitch that I used in several different contests. I knew that one was going to work because my pitch suddenly started having all kinds of reactions. Like, I want to read your book just from that, just knowing about this appendix thing.
You mentioned a little bit about some of the plot points for The Last Great Adventure of the PB&J Society. It deals with some really heavy stuff. A friendship is about to be broken up because the family's losing their house due to foreclosure, which is totally not funny.
Not funny.
So you're balancing that really heavy material with those lighter moments. So do you plot or plan out like beats for humor, or do you just let it happen organically?
My gut reaction is no, I don't plot it, but I think that's not true either, because I do plot. I am a plotter. I'm not a pantser. I have my chapters, like this is what's going to happen in the chapter. For this book in particular, I'd written a whole book before I had the plot. I mean, it's terrible. My first book was about Annie and her craziness and all the funny stuff that she did. And then at the very end, she learned that her friend had to move. There was no plot. Mm. Then the whole recession hit, foreclosures left and right. And I knew someone who was facing it and had kids. It really struck me, like, wow, these kids have to go through this super hard thing. They have zero control. Like, parents probably feel like they don't have much control in that situation, but kids have even less than that. And they still have to face it. They still have to go through the foreclosure, all the effects of it, the moving, finding new friends. Like, what would that be like? And that's kind of what inspired me to do that. But I always had this basis of this character, Annie, who was crazy, just so eager and determined. And I think that's where the humor comes from. And so the balancing act comes in that I know I've got this thing that's not funny. Foreclosure is not funny. And in the book, I never make fun of foreclosure. We are never laughing at foreclosure, not even once. But it's everything around it is fair game. Everything that mm-hmm. she does to try to prevent it. And so that's, I think, where the real balancing act came for me. Like, these are the things I can make fun of, and these are the things I cannot. And mm-hmm. making sure that I recognized what that was from the get-go. You're right. This is a hard thing people go through. And if I were making fun of that, I don't think I would have done very well with my book. I wouldn't have found an agent. It wouldn't have resonated with people because it's not funny. We need something to help us get through the hard things without falling into a deep depression and not being able to function. You know, we have to keep living. And so yeah. we use humor to get through life. It's, I think, teaching kids that if you can find those things that are funny in life, things that are okay to laugh at, you're going to be better off. You're going to be happier. I didn't necessarily plot, oh, I'm going to be funny here and not here. But I did mm-hmm. choose, I'm going to put Annie in this situation, and what is the funniest thing that could happen? For example, in the bake sale, Annie's dad, who recently lost his job and is now a stay-at-home dad, is going to be making cookies for this bake sale. He has mm-hmm. not made cookies before, and yeah, they don't turn out so well. Instead of selling these cookies that are black and hard as a rock as cookies, she sells them as hockey pucks.
So you mentioned earlier that you do write in layers so that there will be something there for kids that might return to the book when they're older and they're going to find things that they didn't recognize as they were younger readers. One of my favorite books when I was growing up was A Wrinkle in Time. I read them all. Swiftly Tilting Planet is an amazing book.
Yes. I was just talking about that with my mom the other day, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Totally love that book.
Oh, love it. And I went back and read them again in my 30s, kind of as a question of, does this stand up? Not only does it stand up, it's not about the things I thought it was about.
Right?
You know, I reread it and I'm like, my mind is blown at the artistry that went into this, that I return as an adult and it truly is a mirror and I'm seeing things that I never would have seen as a child that are so powerful, and the entire meaning of the book and its existence and the author's intent and purpose is completely different.
Yes.
And maybe I'll read it when I'm 60 and I'll see something else. So what books for you can you think of that really worked for you in that way?
Narnia is one mm-hmm. that I always go back to. I read that as a kid. I had the box set, which I still own to this day. Super, super warm.
The white one?
Yes, the white one.
Yes.
You have that one too?
That's yes, of course I do. And then, which I understand the intent, but they re-released them in a different order and hurts my heart.
Right? That's not how it goes.
That's wrong. That's not the first book.
No. What are you thinking?
I see this in my students. Well, they'll talk to me about Star Wars, and I'm like, which one are you talking about? And they're like, well, the first one. And I mean, oh, okay, so A New Hope? And they're like, no, that's the fourth one. I'm like, you are, no, that is first one.
No, I just went on a school visit where we had this very conversation. And I'm like, so the real first one? And they're like, well, that's A Phantom Menace. I'm like, no. And all the teachers were with me. They're like, no.
Oh, of course they were. Yeah, yeah, we have this communication barrier where the first Star Wars is A New Hope, and the first Narnia book is
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is not The Magician's Nephew.
No, absolutely not.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Go on. That was a bit of a soapbox.
So I reread that, and all this stuff I totally did not get as a kid. You know, it was just a fun book. and lots of fun adventures. And I did not realize that C.S. Lewis, I didn't know who he was as a kid. I didn't know he was this bird professor or whatever. Yeah, it totally changed so much of the book. I mean, all of them. Beauty by Robin McKinley. I read that as a young kid, and just the story of Beauty and the Beast, I think that's what gave me my love for fairy tales. I love fairy tales. Read that as an adult. Same thing. Like, wow, she is amazing. She is an amazing author. How did she say all this stuff without me ever seeing it? You can't mention this stuff without talking about J.K. Rowling. Same thing with hers. Every time I read it, I'm like, she just blows me away, the layers. Like, how do you write 7 books and have things from the 7th book that you're gleaning from the first? I just, wow. YA was not a thing when we were young. Middle grade was not a thing when we were young. I am so glad that it is now a thing, that there are these books written specifically for kids. Like you said, there's definitely still people who look down on it, like, oh, you're just writing for kids, huh? Well, of course you got published if you're writing for kids. So helpful, as kids are dealing with a lot of the things that adults face, but in their terms, in ways that they can understand and relate to and learn from. I think Harry Potter was a big start in that. I mean, there were books before that, but I feel like people realized just how wonderful middle grade and YA books can be.
This is something about me that is probably a less attractive quality, is that if something is super popular, I generally won't involve myself in it because...
You know what? I'm just like you. I'm just like
you. Oh, God. But generally, if everybody's like, oh, you have... If more than 5 people are telling me, you have to read this or you have to watch that, I am not going to do it. I'm going to put my foot down because...
This is why we get along, Mindy.
I didn't even pick up Harry Potter until I think the 4th or 5th book had come out. But then, of course, by the time the 7th one came out, I'm standing by my mailbox waiting on July 7th of 2007. Yeah. Which I still remember the day because that's who I was. That's who I changed into. I understand that reaction of, oh, they're just children's books, because I felt similarly in some way about Harry Potter. Like you were saying, when we were kids, a lot of the writing that was out there for us was not necessarily complex. There was some really good stuff, don't get me wrong.
No, absolutely.
But a lot of it was pretty simple. I remember reading a book that was about a girl who had a puppy, and she had to hide the puppy in the basement because her mom wasn't going to be happy with her because she wasn't allowed to have a puppy, and so she's hiding it. And that was the whole plot of the book. There was no weight to this. So I went from I'm hiding a puppy in the basement to Cujo, where a dog's going to kill you and you're going to die in your car and your kid's going to die too unless you figure something out, you know?
Yeah, it's a big jump.
So I love seeing these books out here for the kids now that tackle issues and tackle them in ways that the kids can relate to and that they can function with, because, you know, we talked before about empathy. And us as the authors having empathy, which is what makes us able to execute the characters. I think that's also so important to note, that reading builds empathy. So many studies have found this. You're putting yourself in someone else's shoes through fiction, and it helps understand them.
Definitely. And that empathy is what makes you a good human being. We need books. We need to have books that we can relate to, books that deal with situations we deal with. And kids need that just as much as adults do. I feel like I am really lucky in that regard. I don't know. Lucky maybe isn't the word. I never really grew past middle grade books. My mom was a teacher. She taught 2nd grade and 1st grade. And then she switched to special ed and became an administrator and a reading specialist. And so books were always really huge to her. So we would often take trips to the bookstore and she'd let us choose one. She loved books for middle grade readers. They weren't called that at the time, but that's what she was always choosing, and she would read them to us. So as I got older, I started into the YA books and I dropped right back down to middle grade pretty fast. And so when I started writing, I thought I was writing YA. Sent my very first thing off to an agent. She's like, you know, this is not YA, right? This is middle grade. Like, and then I started looking at all the books I read. I'm like, yeah, okay, that makes sense, because I read middle grade books. Of course I'm writing middle grade books. I feel like they express so much empathy and understanding of the world around us, I haven't felt that need to go past to what's considered adult literature, and I think I need to.
I read a lot of middle grade when I was working in library with middle graders because I wanted to be able to recommend books to my kids that were good for them and fit them as a reader, etc. So I would read a lot, but I have not been working in the library since this past summer, so that has fallen off a bit. But I have a weakness for picture books. Oh. And people think that's weird because I write pretty graphic stuff. For whatever reason, there's something about picture books. When I work down at the elementary, and I've been volunteering down at the elementary every now and then, and I will go in and I will just look at these. My favorite right now, have you seen Big Cat, Little Cat by Elisha Cooper?
No, I'm going to write that down.
Big Cat, Little Cat by Elisha Cooper. It's about a cat, the older cat, the adult cat. A kitten comes in, and at first, you know, it's a bumpy friendship, and then they become very close, and Big Cat dies, and Little Cat is now the big cat. At the end of the book, a kitten comes in, and there's a new little cat. I was freaking crying. I mean, this book is stunning. It just came out. It came out March 14th. It's from Roaring Book Press. I cannot recommend this book enough to anyone.
Especially now. Picture books are very sparse of language. And it's almost like that sparseness allows you to absorb the theme and the meaning just that much deeper. I know not everyone is a fan of the shorter picture books, but I really love these picture books that do so much with so few words. It's amazing.
I think, again, comes into play when people consider, when readers consider writing, which is a wonderful thing. The only reason I'm a writer is because I was a reader first.
Absolutely.
But so many times people look down their noses even further at children's picture book writers because they're like, well, that's not hard. I can write 40 words and publish it. It's like, yeah, but is each one important? Is each word carrying great weight? And to my understanding, children's book, picture books are actually the hardest industry to break into.
Yes.
Because everyone thinks they can do it. And it's actually a very specific, very difficult form.
Yes, it is. You know, I have a friend who her YA book came out last year as well as her first picture book. So two at the same time. And we talked about the revision process. She's like, okay, yeah, I had a long revision letter and whatever with the long YA book that I had. She said in my picture book, though, the revision for that was so much harder. Every single word had a comment on it. And sometimes it was a good comment and I didn't have to change that word, but it was so hard to make it shine with so few words and get every word exactly right. I aspire to write a picture book that's published one day. Having tried it, I've, you know, gotten critiques and feedback from editors and agents, and it's hard. It's definitely harder than writing a book that's 250 pages long.
People don't understand that the length is not the challenge.
No.
It's giving vibrant life to every sentence. And in the case of picture books, every word, you have to be so careful.
And every word, you have to get across so much meaning in so few words. Do you need that "the" there?
I can't even imagine. I don't have that particular skill. That's a very specific skill, one that I don't have. And I enjoy reading picture books. It's not a trait that a lot of people would really assign to me, but it's there. I love them.
You know, I probably wouldn't have guessed that about you either, I'll be honest. But
no, that's fine.
It just makes me love you that much more.
So. Yes, I have a soft center. You just have to really chisel to get through to it. To end out, why don't you give us some of your social media follows so listeners know where they can find you online?
Absolutely. So on Twitter, I'm at Ms. Verbose. My website is janetsumnerjohnson.com, and from there you can access my blog. I am on Facebook, Janet Johnson. There's like a billion of us, so that's why I've got Sumner in there.
Writer Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis, music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow author Alyssa Palombo and patrons Stephen Avery and R.C. Lewis for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer pants on fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.